First of all, I'd like to know how many of you here are for the first time. Will you raise your hands? Right here. Good. Thank you. It's good to see you here. Every year it seems to be that Rob and his group bring these together. There's so many new people that keep coming back, and this particular exposition seems to be one of the best in the country, not only the country, but in the world.
Wait, see, hold on. How much did you say I had to pay you for that?
I have another good word to say about you, but I'm near the end.
Can you turn it up?
I would like to first of all tell you, for those of you who don't know it, I was born on December 26th. That's St. Stephen's Day. I'm Stephen. And I was born in 1911, which makes me 95 years old this coming September. A lot of people, the good Lord, thank him for all the things that have happened to me so far. I'm very, very happy. I want to start telling you things about where I started in the industry and more about the people who were in the industry at the beginning. But before I do that, I just want to compliment Joe and Mike about the information you received about Gottlieb. I just want you to know we at Genco at the time, and Genco at the time, knew that Gottlieb was one of the greatest companies in the world. They have some of the greatest games in the world, and we as competitors did the best to copy some of them so we could be staying in business. And of course, there are a lot of stories that I could tell out of class, that when one company would have a new game that was due to be tested at one location, because nobody was supposed to know where the location was at, competitors would always like to find where that location was at, see the game before it came into production, and try to copy some of the new ideas that were put in them. It worked out very, very good. It would not work the same way with us, with Lion Manufacturing, was what that would turn out to be Bally eventually, after Ballyhoo, and of course, Gottlieb.
The most memorable story is they're sitting at lunch and they get a phone call and Humpty Dumpty was out on location and they said, Bally's got something. And all hell broke loose and you didn't leave lunch, because lunch was good at the Gottlieb. But they all left lunch and they all hopped in and they drove out and they were scared. I mean, genuinely, legitimately scared, because they thought the flipper was going to be it. And they went out there and seeing Nudgy was the biggest sigh of relief that all of them had, because for lack of a better figure of speech, they referred to it as a nothing.
That's correct. Harry Mabbs, who was responsible for that, I worked with him at the beginning when I came to Williams, and gave him a lot of credit. And credit at a time he really did not receive that he should have gotten. When they did come out, well, I'll talk more about that later on. Let me first of all talk about Genco. There were three brothers who came from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and they came here to Chicago. One of them came first, Lou Gensberg, who at that time was making gimmicks for Cracker Jack. Every time you bought a Cracker Jack package, you always found a little something inside of it. Well, he was making these gimmicks by the thousands, making a good piece. When his two brothers, Dave and Meyer, found out that they were doing well, they came here and they got involved. At first, they were distributing chocolate bars all over the city and finally fell into the business. And to begin with, something that maybe everybody doesn't know, but it was in 1930, 2 years before the first Pling Ping game ever came out, that Genco came out with a game called Hearts, H-A-R-T-S. And it was done by Harvey Heiss. And I have a lot to talk and tell you about Harvey Heiss, which is very, very interesting and informative. Anyway, a couple years later, Genco got into the pin game business, just like everybody else did, and did very, very, very well for many years. And they called themselves Genco, not Genco, They were the Ginsberg brothers. So it's so Genko, the Ginsberg brothers. That's why they call themselves Genko. And they had a background that I was told, especially Dave used to tell me, that his father in Pennsylvania always used to tell him, if ever you're going to be in any business, remember to buy real estate. Buy real estate. Buy real estate. Can you imagine at that time in the early 30s what some of this equipment it could be purchased for? Well, there was a time, I remember, when after Genko had purchased maybe hundreds of locations in the city of Chicago on corners where there were stores and apartments above, they had all these these buildings, they were buying them, and of course, as real estate prices went up higher and higher and higher, they had quite a package there. I remember one time being in the office with Ms. Gendron, the secretary. She showed me a stack about 8 inches deep with only but the tax bills that they had for the things that they had. Anyway, let me get back to Harvey Heiss. Harvey Heiss was a designer for Gottlieb for many, many years. And when I came to Genko in April of 1937, I fell in there by accident to get a job, and I found while myself working in a company that had made pin games, and I never saw a pin game in my life at that time. It put me in a very, very wonderful position. I had a slight electrical background in college, and because of that, I fell very well into the business, because at that time, they were changing games from battery power to electrical power. And at that time, they were using in the games these large C cells. Do you know what I'm talking about? The cells were about 9 inches long and about 3 inches in diameter, and they were used those for the, making the sounds on the games, the lights, lighting up the games, and so forth. And when we change it to electrical power with the plugs, you may be amazed to know that we received many, many calls from the companies that purchased our games as, where in the heck do we plug these games? You think they would have outlets along the walls or somewhere else? They certainly did not. At that time, they were putting up for the light fixtures and extension and down to the where the game was at. That's how we were playing the games at that time.
One of early on when they first started with the electric games with the cords, my great uncle Saul, they were at a trade show and they had one of these games up in the room, and even the guys at the factory were kind of wary and not quite sure about this new technology. And they're up in the room showing off of this game, and all of a sudden smoke starts coming out of the electrical outlet. And my uncle Saul is standing, great uncle Saul, standing in front of the electrical outlet like this, trying to fan it away so nobody notices what goes on. Turns out the hotel was on fire. So everybody got out, and it wasn't the Gottlieb game. It just so happened that the hotel was on fire, and the smoke was coming out of the outlet.
Harvey Heiss never really got the credit he deserved for all he did for Genko. But there was a time it took Robert Burke and the Pinball Expo to invite him here several years ago, and some of the stories that he started to tell, I tell you, I can't repeat some of them, but they were terrific. And they put this all on tape, and I just certainly hope that maybe next year, Rob and his group will find a section in their schedule to put this on for about an hour, just put his talk on it. It'll drive you buggy. He was terrific. Anyway, Harvey Heiss was a character of his own. He owned a sailboat on Lake Michigan. And that sailboat was about 36 feet. I'm not a sailor, so if I move this up, you'll understand. It was a boat about 36 feet long, had a cabin in which you could sleep in, and had a mast about 45 feet tall. Anyway, I was there for 4 or 5 years with him, racing with this boat on Lake Michigan, and it was one heck of a time we used to have. The only trip I regret never making with him was the one they used to make regularly from Chicago to Mackinac Island. That was something that I wish I had been on one, but it never was. Anyway, Harvey Heiss had this boat at Belmont Harbor. And what happened is every fall, he would get several of the people together he'd take his mast off of his boat and put it on his I'm trying to think of the name of the car, but I don't know, but it was a roadster. He'd get this long mast on his roadster with lat flags on either side of him, and a car in front and a car in back, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, we were driving all the way from Belmont Harbor down to Ashland Avenue and brought the mast up the blue. The company put it into the window on top, of, that's where it was for the winter. And he did work on that mast because he always did something, cleaning it up and painting it and so forth. Anyway, Harvey Hines lived on that boat. There came a time when some young lady got the best of him and he got married. Well, Harvey Hines still found himself on occasion sleeping more on the boat, I think, than at home. Here he finds himself, there was a time his wife gave him a notice, either the boat or I, one or the other. Well, I think it took Harvey Hines about a month to decide. And finally, he sold his boat to somebody in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We never saw the boat again. It was an exciting experience, and I'll never forget that. Harvey Hines did a lot of good for the company and also for me. I learned from him everything that there was to be known about how to design things, what to do to make it interesting, what to do to make it so that people would like to play them, why they would like to play them, and it had a lot to do with something that I had to do with in the future. There was a time when the war, just before the war, that was in November of 1941, we came out with a game called Victory, called V-I-C-T-O-R-Y. And it was all bumper bolts. It was very, very exciting. And it came out in November of 1941. What happened December 1941? Pearl Harbor. Well, I don't have to tell you that during the war, all the companies that were at one time, particularly all the pen game companies, were involved in doing something for the war effort. And we couldn't get silver contacts anymore. That was brought out. We couldn't get our bronze type of material for the leaves of the switches that we were using. Couldn't use copper anymore for coils. So naturally, we all went out of business making pin games. In fact, we couldn't make any pin games, but we got involved in the war effort, and everybody did something for the war effort. We did it, can't go like everybody else did. We were very, very active. We had some 800 people in our place making walkie-talkies for the Marines. And one of the things I'll never forget that I was involved in is that we made a piece of equipment that had a string of wires put together, about 40, 50 wires. And every single wire was exactly the same color, could not be changed. And the reason for that was because what we were making were cables for anti-air equipment for airplanes that were used on the airplanes. And that they were afraid that if ever the airplane was taken over by any one of the people that we were fighting, they could never determine how this thing would work out because they couldn't trace the circuits on it. And I'll never forget that. And I'm sure that every other company in the business, including Gottlieb, did something in this effort. We all had something to do in this effort. And it was only because we had a staff of people who knew how to solder and who knew how to work and put together the equipment like we did. I remember teaching girls how to solder in a 1-inch plug 15 different wires and how to do that without making them shorting it out. That was a job to learn. And I had people that would learn them. They would come to us and work during the times when the kids were in school or away. And we were just taking anybody that we could get to be able to get them to work. I'm sure Gottlieb had something in that too.
Yeah, Gottlieb manufactured parachute hooks, and then all of the people in management in the coin machine industry were busy selling war bonds. right? I mean, they were, some percentage of their time was trying to run the company, but I know that a lot of them were out rallying around trying to convince people and everybody to buy war bonds. That was the big pushback then.
I'd like to tell you that what happened is we at Genco were the only company in the entire industry who worked on DC. All of our coils, everything we had in the game worked on DC. We did not have AC coils. We did not have a motor to drive the equipment to score. And what would we did probably just some things that the people using the motors to score couldn't do. And it was very exciting for us to be able to save money and be able to build games that were very, very attractive, particularly a game Total Role. If you can remember Total Role, the one in which we rolled a 2-inch ball up an incline and did the scoring for us. Total Role, we made sold out on many of those cabinets. It was almost unbelievable. And this is something that many people don't even know. At that time, Howard Hughes in California was building that plywood airplane. You remember that?
Spruce Goose.
Yeah, Spruce Goose. Well, he had so many panels left over from the building of this plane that Dave Gensburg somehow got to know him and got him to build cabinets for us with these birch panels. And not only that, twice a week, we would have an airplane fly from California with 80 of these cabinets in the plane just to be able to take care of the demands that we had, because we had three other manufacturing companies making for us cabinets. They could not keep up with the number of games that we were making. Those are the times when you're making good money. Getting back to the real estate taxes. I remember the time when Dave and Lou and Meyer did something to its key employees that I don't think any other company did in dollars to keep us from going to another company. They gave us annuity policies. And every time we made an extra, well, first of all, let's say they gave us an annuity policy of which we took a percentage of that money into this annuity, and the company would double it. So these that was very exciting. But you couldn't trade those in. At least 3 years you had to be there in order to get a percentage of the payment out of it. Almost had to be 10 years to get the full 100%. But about every time you got a raise, you got another raise in 2-3 years, another policy would come out, another policy would come out, another policy would come out. It got so that you hear you've got all these policies with all this money, you don't want to go anywhere else. So you think, like Judd Heimberg was telling me, he was trying to get me to come to Gottlieb. I got such a kick of meeting him. It was great to see him. Well, you just think twice before you make a decision like that. Anyway, what happened is we went ahead and did the best we could with that money. What happened, when Harvey Heist left, he went to North Miami and bought himself a double ranch home, two ranch homes together that paid with the annuity policies. When I left Genco to go to work with first of all, with Belly for a year and a half, and then to Williams, I had that money to use for my kids to go to college, which helped them tremendously. So it was something that we never forgot, and we appreciated. In the meantime, Gensburg Brothers had all this money, stock coming in. They decided in 57 or 58 to build the first high-rise hotel in Las Vegas, the Riviera. They invested in this, and they got together with a group of other people that, because they didn't have enough money to build this, but they had enough to get started, and they took over. They took over, and they decided, since they thought they were some of the smartest people in the world, to run their casino in the lower level. I don't have to tell you they didn't make any money. In fact, they lost money running the casino. Well, when they finally got to the right people and were able to sell that casino and get a good return on them to the proper people, then they really started making money. And I, for years, I tell you, I heard from them. They were telling me that what a time they had. And they were all retired in California, and they all passed away. And it was exciting to know that the money from the Penn Games helped build that Riviera Hotel. There's a lot of other things I would like to talk about, but I like to keep some of this down and quiet, and it would be better if I could let all of you do some asking of questions. Maybe I can answer some of them for you. I just want you to know that the time that I spent in Genco were some of the best years of my life. And the time when I came to Bali, because when Genco closed up and I was available to any company that wanted me because of my designing background, and because we did a lot of gun games using Remington rifles, we did one heck of a job at making gun games. What happened is we went ahead and decided we were free to go somewhere. I had three people that were working for me at Genco, an electrical man, a mechanical man, and a man who was responsible for putting the games online. And I felt so badly about them. How could they get a job after all these years working for Genco? But everybody wanted to hire me. I went to see United. He wanted to hire, but he wouldn't take the three people that we had. I went to other companies. I even went to Seabird. And I went to Seabird for a reason. I went to Seabird for a reason. Because they blew it on a gun game. And we had very great experience in gun games. Made a lot of them. Made them good. And they discussed this with me at the board meeting and refused to take us. You know why they refused to take us? To a year and a half before then, they had built a gun game. And it was a raccoon running up a post and down. Good game. What do you think they called it? Coon Hunt. Can you imagine selling that game in the South? They blew it. They not only blew it, they burned 1,000 of their games in the back of the Seabird plant. Burned them. And since I knew they had that funny background with the gun games, I tried to get them to hire us. And they didn't even want to think about guns, so we didn't get it. And I wasn't going to go to any company unless I get somebody to take our four people together. I went to United, and I had one egg at a time when he wanted to hire me because, what was his name? I forget it.
Lynn Durant?
And, yeah, and he, boy, you know what kind of place he had. And I just couldn't go in there because he wouldn't take the other boys. So I did a job going to see a good friend of mine, Bad Belly, Lynn, our good friend. And I went to see him. And he said to me, I'll take all four. I said, okay, we'll go. So here we go. And I said, I'm in trouble. So he said, you got trouble? I'll take all four of you. So all four of us went to Bali. What happened is a year and a half later, I got a call to get from Sam Stern to come to Williams at the time to build games. And at that time, Harry Williams and Sam Stern were co-owners of the company. I had to go then to Bill O'Donnell and say, Bill, I got a problem. He says, what's your problem now? I said, I got a good offer for making pin games. I sure would like to ask you to relieve me. He says, you got a good job? Take it. But don't dare take any one of the three guys that you brought here with you. Did you know that every one of those three boys have retired from belly, doing very, very, very well? That's how well they were trained in Genko to do what they were able to do and how well they did at belly. Every one of them retired from belly. In the meantime, I was very fortunate to come to Williams, where I met Harry Mabbs, got talking to him, and they wanted a replacement for Harry because Harry at that time was about 75 years old, and I was about 40-something. And I was very fortunate to come there, and I had the good fortune of being able to build games. I get a kick out of this because some people will never believe me unless I tell you this. When I started to get with Williams, about a year after I started, Harry Mabbs left and retired and went to live in Hollywood, Florida. And we went to visit him quite often. And he was doing very, very well and did very well. Anyway, I came to Williams, and in 1961, I built 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 games. 9 games. But in those days, when you ordered something for a game, you went down the line and talked to the people that were making parts for the game. They'd say, well, should we make, how many should we make them? So I tell him, instead of making 1,000 parts, make 5,000. Well, you got the die-in because I'm going to be using the same parts of the game. And it came over and over again, except for some features on the game. In 1962, next year, I was the only designer there at that time. I built 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 games. And they started off with, just so you know, Metro, Jolly Rogers, Three Coins, Corvette, Trade Winds, Friendship 7, that's a terrific game. Valiant, Vagabond for the first drop target, and then Mardi Gras and Four Roses. And that went on and on, on and on and on. 1963, starting off with 10. Tom Tom, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, I dropped back. Last game was, the last game was Beat the Clock. That's the one that had two balls on the play field playing at the same time. And it was very good. And then finally, I got Norm Clark to team up with me. And that gave me a hell of a lot of opportunities to do some of the things I have never done before in big games. And with him designing and my designing, we alternated. He would have one game, I would have another game. And we worked together so closely that whenever he had a problem, he'd call me and we'd discuss and talk about what to do, correct it, or to improve it. If I thought I had a need or problem, I'd call him, we'd discuss it. And that was something that I guess Sam Stern was aware of we were doing. And I guess he knew that we were doing it, but what could he do? We were turning out very good games, great games. And when we started, just remember, I want you to know that when I was started there, the game there, we were making only 300, 400 games of a run. People would work on them 2 weeks, send them to go home, all went home. Then when the next game was ready, a week later, they'd telegram them or call them, and they'd come back, then he would start knowing. It was not until about the fourth game, third year, that we finally hit 1,000. Then about 2 years later, we hit 2,000, then 5,000, then up to 16 to 18, 15 to 16,000, the space mission and so forth. Anyway, it was very, 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 we did very, very well. We can't complain. The industry has been very, very good to us, very good to me and to my family. Oh, I forgot to tell you, I got married along the line. I was married in January 1941. That was just a year before Pearl Harbor. Boy, what a time. When you're married, you got a child coming, and then you're thinking, boy, oh boy, everybody's getting drafted, you're wondering what's going to happen. Well, I never got drafted, although they put me in charge at Genco to take care of the 800 people that were doing the soldering and working. And whenever they wanted a draft, they'd come to me and say, "Hey, we'll make a lieutenant out of you. Just come on and join." I said, "Well, if the company releases me, I'll go." They said, "The company won't release you." "Well, then I won't go." I had two brothers in the service, so I thought that was good enough. Anyway, I don't know what else to tell you except to tell you that, as I said it, we had one hell of a time. And my time at Harvey Heights was something I'll never forget. The time that I spent with Sam Stern as our boss, who was one of the smartest people as a manager, as a president in this industry. People never knew that, but he knew a game was good or bad just by looking at it. He was terrific in helping. He did very, very well for the company, for us, and of course for himself. So it worked out very, very good. Anything else?
Yes, real quick. Wayne Nance told me on the phone the other day he really wanted to be here and hang out with you, but his wife is not in the best of health. Can you please say hi to Wayne for me?
Hello, Wayne. How are you?
Thank you very much.
I visit him when I visit my brother. He's also in the same town, Mountain Home, Arkansas. What a place. Oh, good place. Retirement. Yes, sir.
There's a 1939 Genco rink on the floor out there. Do you have any memories of making that game?
No, sir. But I made so many of them at that time. The rink, yes.
Yeah.
We made so many at that time that it's kind of difficult for me to tell you, what I did, because it was such a repetition of games at that time and making them. You didn't know. You take it. See, get out. Here, rink is what was made in 19.
Hey, Steve, while you're looking that up, I want to mention one thing. You know, the one reason that I did Pinball Expo was to recognize my heroes who were the designers. So you can imagine my enthusiasm in the first year, 1985, when at the banquet we had four designers come up front. And there was Norm Clark, who's in the back, by the way. Norm Clark is here. Norm, thanks for coming, buddy. We had Steve Kordek. We had Wayne Nyans and Harvey Heiss. And in many cases, these guys had met for the first time. I don't, because Gollum being the way they were, Wayne never really spoke and spent time together with the guys from Williams or whatever. So I think it was the first time they met, I believe, it was at the Expo. But we had four of them on the panels together, and it was such an exciting moment for us. I'm after hearing him speak about Harvey, I'm going to try to bring up next year's Expo a video of Harvey, some of the seminars he gave. He was a wildcat. And he gave some of the greatest stories, and you couldn't help but laugh, because he had great enthusiasm for life, and he was a wonderful, warm-hearted guy, and we surely miss him. But I'll bring some of those videos next year. I think it'll be fun to see him again, including one that I spent in my room with Harvey and Steve, and then they just went through DePuchel's book and Pasek's books and went through every Genco game one by one, and then they just kind of spoke about those times. And sometimes Harvey would say, "Hey, Steve, you remember that girl?" And then Steve would say, "Let's not talk about that right now." You know, so there was some really interesting tidbits in that. And we'll have to bring that back. But keep going, guys.
I don't remember that girl. A lot of stories we can tell. Sometimes you can't take that open pocket. Anyway, we had one heck of a time. Harvey Heiss was a terrific man. And he did, I tell you. It's like I said, it took Robert Burke and the Pinball Expo to get him here and to show what he did, because he knew every game he'd look at, he knew exactly how it was built, why it was built, and why what parts were put on there, and he was involved in every one of the games. It was very terrific. You were saying there, sir?
Yeah, I was just, a lot of designers from the 90s have been here and told what it was like designing and told how stressful it could be to see their game on a test location for the first time and just hoping that when people played it, they had fun. I want you to tell us what it was like for you with designing and some of the things you were concerned about.
Well, I don't like to say stressful because you get to a point after a while because you do the testing of your game at the plant for a while. Like we never put a game out on location until we set big 10 models. We set them up in a certain location in the factory, and we had them playing day and night. Day and night we'd have to be playing them, and we'd know whether we got the right percentage in payments, we'd know whether anything was going to break down, how some of the units would stand up. So we were pretty well satisfied that we had either a good game or a game not even to be built. So what happened is, when you send them out on location now to test them, and we have several locations, but I'm sure Godly knew where they were at too, like we knew where they had their games. And we went ahead and just had them tested, and we weren't too stressful. We knew pretty well what to expect. It was just a question of how much money is it going to take compared to a game that's next to it, or a game that was built, say, three games before that, it's in the same location. How is it comparing and taking money? That was the important thing.
There wasn't a whole lot of stress to be got laid for Wayne, although there is a story I was told where it was cumulative, where over time Judd and my dad and Bob Smith and these guys all felt very comfortable coming into engineering and playing a game and telling Wayne what they thought about the game. And then it kind of got to the point of where, you know, Dad would come in and play it and say, well, you know, the pop bumpers don't have enough action over here. You need a little bit more action. And he would leave, and then Judd would come in and play it and say, well, the pop bumpers have too much action. You know, you might want to back off on that. And there's a story that one day Judd, my dad, and my grandpa Dave were in there. They were all playing the game and getting into it. And my grandfather, being the way he was, had one of these big cigars. And he says, that's it. Everybody out. Everybody out of the engineering department right now. So they walk out, close the door, and my grandfather looks at Wayne and he says, you're in charge. What you say goes. That's how things are going to work. You can listen to these guys, whatever. What you say goes. And that was it. And he walked out. And that was kind of a turning point where, you know, Wayne knew that whatever he wanted to do, he could do. And he was stubborn, but he was right more times than not. And that eliminated what I would call like the second guessing, meaning that before the public could see the product, people were trying to judge what it was or what it wasn't. And then they would finally get it out on location. And then it was okay for the players to decide if it was too easy or if it was too hard or whatever else. But that was just kind of the dynamic in the engineering department as explained to me.
That's, you're right. The one way we could say is that one person had to be a deciding factor in any decisions of making games in any one company. And if that person had the capabilities of being able to determine how it's to be built and who should be building it, it always worked out very good for the company itself, and the company made money. Yes, sir.
From a historical standpoint, we know most of the stuff that George Melitten did as an artist. He got to meet him at Fast Expo. And we know most of the stuff that Jerry Kelly did after he started with Pot of Gold. And then when Christopher Marché came on and did a lot of the Williams stuff. But the guy we never can get a handle on and all the stuff is that Louis Renard. Do you have any idea if any of his family or anything is still around or anything about him?
No, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know.
Question. One last one, we can't get a handle.
Do you know who did the artwork for Big Daddy and Big Deal?
Yes. I know you. I know what you're talking about. That was a company that was on Clyburn Avenue. It was Reproduction. Company was Reproduction, and at that time, what's his name was in there with that company there at that time. Yeah. But I can't tell you exactly who did it because we had. When we turned out some of these decisions to be made for our artwork to be done, we sometimes didn't even know who was working on it. All we cared about is we got the right results.
Larry?
Steve, who are the three guys that you took from Genco and then took them into Valley with you?
One was Harry Thompson. He was the mechanical man. He was terrific. Then there was Johnny Merzak, He was the man that took care of the took when we gave him a game to go on the line. We didn't have to worry about it anymore after that. He just was out there on the line making sure that it was done and done right. And then we had one electrical man called. You see, sometimes I forget. I'm at a point I'm forgetting something sometimes. So before I get off of this floor, I'll remember. I'll call you back. Yeah, and that was the three people, but including myself. And Bill O'Donnell was very, very generous and good at that. And of course, I don't want to tell you what Belly did. What a hell of a time they had with those games that they were building for that one time. And not only that, I remember when it was called Lion Manufacturing. It wasn't Belly, it was Lion. And then the only time it changed was when they made Belly Hoop.
Steve?
Yes, sir.
Well, we're old friends, and I just wanted to say...
Well, we are friends. Good for you.
You know, I could have stayed back there and watched cartoons this morning.
I liked it. Very good.
I just want to say thanks a lot for all the help you gave me getting started, all the little fixes, advice, friendship. It always amazed me that you had, you know, an answer that I needed often. I thank you, my friend.
I appreciate it very much because I had learned something from Harvey Heiss that lived with me for the rest of my life. And that was when I worked with other people, and in this case I'm working with you, with the other designers, you know, especially Barry Oslo, who I took off the line, you know, and taught him to sing, to teach them in such a way that I did not want to be the deciding factor inherent starting the design of a game. It was their problem. I wanted them to learn that was they, with their game, that were responsible for it's going to make it or not. If I was able to give them a hand in making some changes, I always did that, but never took credit for it. I always felt that the people that were designing the games should get that credit, and they always got it, and I appreciate that because I did that with every one of the designers that ever worked for me.
As there's a sense of perspective, people need to understand something. I don't know of anybody other than Steve Kordek that made the transition. When they went from electromechanical to solid state, I mean, it was like my dad said, you know, solid state was acquired after four martinis. Right. I mean, he didn't solid state to him. It was very foreign. It was scary. It was weird. It was different. And for him and for Judd, they were just done. I mean, who knows if the electromechanical had carried on, maybe they wouldn't have been as interested in selling. So if you think about how impressive it is that Steve, being a designer for decades and decades, was able to evolve and say, here's a new piece of technology. Here's solid state. Now they can talk. Now Steve's doing something with split levels. Now we're doing dot matrix. Now we're doing that. I mean, the genius of Steve is that he has been able to contribute from the dawn of time all the way up until Pinball 2000. Right, think about it. From going from batteries to Pinball 2000. And he was looking at Pinball 2000 with ideas. The man was limitless with ideas and commitment to creativity and doing things that were wonderful and entertaining to the player. And, you know, like Steve says, it's a privilege. It's been a privilege to know you, you know, this number of years, and you're a dear friend of, you know, of my dad. And I worked with Steve a little bit when I worked at Williams, and it was magical. You know, I hope in my life I never lose the creative spontaneity and the, you know, the genius that Steve has.
You live and you learn, and you only learn by working with people that you know are trying to learn themselves, and you give them the credit that they deserve. And I never try to take credit from what they accomplished or what they did or what they tried to do. That's very, very important in life. You just go ahead and remember that time passes on. it's going, and sometimes I wonder. I just want to also repeat one other thing about the flippers. I've said this 100 times, if I said it once. I've seen so many changes in pin games. But when those 6 flippers came out on Humpty Dumpty, 2 on the right top, 2 in the middle on the side, and 2 on the bottom on the right side or left side, boy, that was something to see. And when I had an opportunity, because Harvey Heisman was in the hospital, sick, and when in the first week of December, boss comes up to me, says, Harvey, he's come. Hey, I gotta have a game for January. Don't you know we got a show in Dojan? We don't have a game. Will you do it late seminar? I said, what the hell? I haven't been on any games. I've been working with it. He says, you gotta make a game. Okay, so I sat down and I said, and I looked at this goddamn 6 flippers at the Cotlip game. I said, I gotta do something like that. But I was always taught never to put too much money into a game. I ain't gonna put those 6 flippers on my game. So I put 2 of them, and I put them at the bottom of the game, and that's approximately where they've been ever since, and that makes me feel very, very, very good. It's great. I've said this before, and I'll say this again. The changes that happen in this industry, nothing affect, I don't care where it is, solitaire or what, nothing affected the industry as much as the flippers did in this industry. You could at that time not buy a game that went off flippers. You couldn't sell a game that went off flippers. You couldn't play a game that went off flippers. Even some of the older games that I made that had no flippers, I never saw before in my life, I find them sometimes with 2 flippers in the bottom of the game. I think between Gottlieb and us, we sold more of these added possible flippers for games than anybody else, just kits to put on their games so they could have their games on location to put the flippers.
And Lynn Durant said he would never put flippers on a playfield for a very short period of time.
I have a listing of all the companies that came out for the first time with their flippers, and he's right. Then United was the last one to finally come out with the flippers. About 5 months after we came out with ours, you know, and it's something that I'll never forget. Flippers, that's game. In fact, all over the country and the world, they don't call these penny games; they call them flipper games. So this is very good to know that. Even Norm Clark up there's got a car that's got on it, flippers on it, named Flipper.
Yes. Okay. Naturally, I know we're pressed for time. I have 1-2 questions, time allowing. I have 1,000 because you built most of the games that I own or sold. So, you know, but anyway. All right. First of all, I just want to make a comment. Wayne Nance told me on the phone the other day in a conversation, a tape I was talking about. He said, I asked him, I said, what are your thoughts on Gottlieb going from EM to solid state? He said he hated it. He was not very happy about it. Now, getting into that, Vacation America on the Internet Pinball Database, what did you have to do with that thing? Because I don't know much about that game anyway.
What game?
Vacation America, Chicago Gaming. What did you have to do with that?
Churchill.
Were you really, is that a typo, or did you have something to do with that?
That was a project you worked on a few years ago.
For sure, with John Trudeau.
Yeah, John Trudeau.
Chicago Gaming, it says.
Left.
What about it?
What did you do?
What was your involvement with that game?
I don't remember.
Okay.
So many games that was involved. You know, you can't recall.
Okay, let's grab the one. Then here's the one that I've been dying to ask you. This is what got me here.
On the last birthday
from Richmond, Virginia. This is what I want to ask you. I owned a 21, and I sold it, traded it pretty much for a jumping jack or something, Williams. But anyway, which is a better game, I think. Now that 21 went, and I noticed that you're credited with blackjack. Now, Harry Williams designed 21. What was going on there? It was the same year, 1960.
This is a trivia
kind of. Just a quick thing for you people that want to add this to your record. Steve's the game he thought was the worst game he ever designed was Bobo. So put that in your archives.
What year?
1960.
And while he's looking that up in regard to Gottlieb going from electromechanical to solid state, no, they had absolutely no use for it whatsoever. They jobbed it out to Rockwell. Amazingly enough, the limitations of their mindset were such that they sent Rockwell an electromechanical pinball machine and said, here, replicate this. Now think about that for a second. They didn't say, this is what our product is. Do something in solid state that goes beyond in terms of memory, being able to remember your, you know, remember this, or remember that, or hold over whatever. It was replicate this. So it was a very limiting mindset. I know for my dad, being a ham radio operator and big at electrical engineering, he was very concerned of the static electricity concerns, piezo lighters. He was concerned you could take a piezo lighter and with the piezo lighter be able to crack up credits on there and, you know, and do stuff, you know, because he was, his mindset was always, these are products going into commercial locations and they need to be industrial in their, you know, kind of their ability to last. Also, they had huge concerns, and this is why they ran single player electromechanicals in Bensonville for so much longer and Gottlieb waited as long as they could, is that while in the United States, there were young electrical engineers learning solid state, coming out of school and going to work at distributors and operators. Over in third world countries, you know, like Saudi Arabia, where they were actually operating machines, even if you knew how to diagnose a solid state problem, where are you going to get the parts? How are you going to figure out how to repair this thing? Whereas any electromechanical game, you could go through and repair. And interestingly enough, my dad, because the internet is great for everybody, my dad saw on the internet that they were discontinuing, and Tim Arnold mentioned this to him as well, they were discontinuing certain, like the 6502 Rockwell processors and some other parts that were used on the Gottlieb games. And my dad says, see, I told you. And I said, what? He said, 20 years from now, you're not going to be able to fix a Cleopatra or a Sinbad. Forget it. You won't be able to fix it. But you can. I guarantee you, you'll be able to bring a Dragonette back to life. You might have to call Don Murphy or Steve Young, but you're going to be able to bring a Dragonette back to life. So.
Rick Stitt, I don't know if Rick's in the audience right now, but we played until 4 in the morning, some guy's Cleopatra EM, and I guarantee you enjoyed that 10 times better than Solid State if it had been there. I got to say that. He played the heck out of it.
Yeah, there was. I also remember that they couldn't stand the tone board. That the Williams soundboard was a lot cooler, and people just and the Bally, the you know, it was cooler. And the Gottlieb soundboard, nobody at Gottlieb really liked the net result because they thought chimes were just so much better.
Right.
Well,
guys, we have a question.
Way back there. Way back there. She's translating what he's saying.
My name is Brandon K. I was a designer for the Solid State Pinball Board. I met you in a factory. I saw and I heard about you. I thought you thought that I was hearing, but I'm not, I'm deaf. And you were amazed, you were surprised that I was deaf, but that I was a designer for all these boards. And I realized that, oh, for all this time, I'm a deaf man and I've been designing these boards. I'm so happy to know you. I'm very, very excited to have met you before.
Thank you. Thank you very kindly. Ray is one of the people that worked like a dog in these places and nobody ever could pay much attention. Except people that knew what he was accomplishing, knew what he was doing, and it was very, very important to have a man like him. Even if he couldn't express himself to people so they could understand, but he did it, Giada, it was unbelievable.
Ask Ray to come up front when we're done here. We'll have to get a picture with Steve.
Larry?
Yes, Larry.
That's Ray Gay. He worked with us at Williams and at Midway for quite a number of years. He laid out the printed circuit board, and Ray, the technology at the time that the first printed circuit boards were made, which Ray laid out, you weren't using CAD systems on computers, which is what they use now. You almost can put in a circuit and the computer will pop out a printed circuit board. But in the 70s, when this was done, the circuit boards were laid out by putting tape, literally laying out like masking tape in the pattern of the board, and then that was photographed and etched and mass produced into the boards.
Yeah, and you had
had to hand check that your traces that you were laying down with the tape matched what was drawn on the schematic.
Okay, and Ray worked at Williams and Midway for
years.
I don't know if it was 15 or 20.
36
years.
36
years, excuse me. And one great story, Ray is very good at reading lips, and then Ray is very easy to have a conversation with him. And that's why it was a long time before Steve even realized that Ray couldn't hear.
Ask him to come up front, honey, would you? Ask Ray to come up front.